it sounds from when I've watched many of her YouTube, I don't think she's quite a quantum physicist. She kind of takes the viewpoint of a physicist that's kind of not in that field to discuss it. But she is quite interesting and entertaining and informative. Has a bit of an accent, but we all do. I think she's good. There are a lot of very smart people doing very smart YouTubes out there.
Yeah, Sabine Holzenfelder, PhD in physics, working as a professor in Frankfurt Institute of Advanced Studies. It's not about her. She happened to be a singer and a professor at the same time. Not a great singer, but a good singer. I love it very much. But it is not about that. It is about the ITER. ITER is the International Nuclear Fusion Research and Engineering, and that's the answer for the problems that we had in Chernobyl and plenty of other nuclear stations that we are eventually afraid of them blowing up like it happened in Fukushima. So I thought we may say a few words about it. It's a new project of many nations. We have some nations that I would love, I love that they are there, and some nations that I don't, but that's the reality. We have European nations, there's 28 nations, if I remember. We have a China, India, Japan, Russia, I'm not sure if that was a good idea, South Korea, United States, United Kingdom, Switzerland, and Euratom. Euratom. Where is Euratom? Participate the Euratom. While the project has cooperation agreement with Australia, Kazakhstan, and Canada.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, Wesley, when you unkey, you got to give people a couple of seconds, because I ended up talking under you, and probably no one heard me. But anyway, if you actually go to my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, the second article on my science talk is called The Marathon Race Towards Fusion Power Could Be Reaching a Sprint, and it's all about ITER.
Okay, thank you for the right spelling, ITER. I spell it ITER. ITER, yeah. Just a few words. It is estimated for total $65 billion, but if we compare it to the International Space Station, there was $100 billion plus budget, and the Large Hadron Collider was only $7.5 billion budget. We don't say it's something major. It's something very important. So what people expect is that with the contribution of all of these nations, soon in 2023, they would be able to produce 500 megawatts of power when delivering 50 megawatts of power of energy. And that's what that singer professor was actually putting in question. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what the point is. This is another experimental attempt at demonstrating the value of nuclear fusion, which is a much nicer, cleaner way of getting energy than fission, because it doesn't entail the creation of decay products that last hundreds of thousands of years and produce radioactive material that kills people, it gives them cancer, and all kinds of fun stuff. So the problem, though, with this study is that although it will demonstrate for the sake of physics that you can do a fusion reaction where there's no net big energy cost, it's not quite at the point that they're proving that it's cost effective. And in order for industry to invest billions and trillions of dollars, it has to be cost effective. At the end of the day, you have to be able to demonstrate that you get a significant amount of power out much more than the power that you put in to create the fusion and to create the materials needed for the fusion. So it's an intriguing study. I wish them luck. I hope them the best. It still doesn't mean that fusion is a few years away, unfortunately. I wish it did. It's, like I said, unfortunately, it's always been 20 years away since 1960.
WA2EGT.
Yes, what would you like to say?
Yes, you're announcing EGT.
Yes.
Great. This is WA2EGT. My name is Charlie. I was listening earlier. I don't usually go on 2 meters. I'm an HF brass pounder. But this conversation was interesting. I just happened to catch it. And if you'll indulge me, I just want to back up a little bit, maybe a lot, to something Wesley said. And also, could you please tell me, how long is the timeout? Back to you.
It's about 90 seconds. It might be as long as 120, but I would figure it 90.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. We've spoken before. I'm terribly sorry. I forgot the name and the call sign of Net Control. But just to get back to Wesley, you mentioned Toyota had a hydrogen car. You mentioned a price of, I don't mean to address this personally to you, Wesley, but the price of $15,000. I caught my ear, and I said, no car, new car is $15,000. Just a simple web search. Toyota. Car is the Mirai. This is an interesting thing to look at. I do definitely recommend people to look at this. First, the car is not $15,000. It's $49,500. I think that's a base model. They give you a credit of $15,000 towards hydrogen fuel. That's why where the $15,000 number came from. Plus, they're showing fueling stations. They're breaking this out in California. They had a map. You enter a California zip code. Let me drop for a second. I looked at what a California zip code was, just entered it in, and you see all along California, Southern California and L.A., Northern California, San Francisco, concentration of these hydrogen fueling stations, filling stations by Toyota, trying to roll this out in California. They also addressed the fuel tank issue, which you guys are talking about. It's a polymer wrapped tank. They say it can absorb 5 times the crash energy of steel. And when you think about it, and Wesley alluded to this, you know, basically you're sitting on a bomb, you know, with gasoline in your fuel tank. We don't think anything of it unless we own a Pinto or something like that. But, you know, they're trying to address it. This is interesting. I'm going to drop again. Sorry, I'm so hyper. What caught my attention to this was, I remember, like, in the early 60s, a kid sitting with my dad, and my dad served in the European theater in World War II. And he said, when he went into Germany, of course, they had fuel shortages because of the war. That they were using hydrogen engines for motorbikes, for this, that, and the other thing. And he was intrigued by that, especially seeing the exhaust was water. I remember as a kid him saying, we've got to look into it. We've got to develop that technology. You know, that's a fantastic thing. That's just a personal side note. But this website, with this Toyota vehicle, I haven't read through the whole thing, but it's definitely worth a search, and I don't work for Toyota. Toyota hydrogen car, and it'll come up with the Mirai. I'm pronouncing M-I-R-A-I. Fascinating. Back to you, Ned.
WB2EAB.
Okay, very good, Charlie. Thank you. By the way, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. Yeah, I just looked it up. I wish I could kind of look up a lot of things and talk and listen simultaneously. So that's an interesting addition. Thank you for that, Charlie. Ed, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. Hydrogen is a fascinating alternate liquid fuel that it doesn't have the weight penalty of batteries. So as I said before, if you want to have a trans-Pacific flight, hydrogen might be an alternative fuel. But hydrogen, definitely problematic also. First of all, as we all know, hydrogen is an extremely light gas. If you want to get it in a high energy density, you have to liquefy it, which takes tremendous pressure, and the tanks must withstand that pressure. And historically, they've had to be fairly significant steel tanks, kind of like your propane barbecue tank. Now, it's possible Toyota has gotten to a lighter tank that is just as strong as possible. Here's the main issue. There is no natural source of elemental hydrogen on Earth. You have to convert something else. And the classy way right now is electrolyzing water. Now, the question is, what is the net system efficiency of taking water, adding electricity to get the hydrogen, pressing the hydrogen, transporting the hydrogen, running an engine? What percentage of the electricity used to electrolyze the water actually comes out at the far end? And I think it's pretty low, and they're working very hard to raise it up, but there's a limit to how far it's ever going to go. So that's the good and the bad with hydrogen, right?
Yeah, thank you, Wes. I have reported on in the past people using interesting catalytic materials to improve the efficiency of electrolyzing water. I mean, way back in high school, I did an experiment to figure out Avogadro's number, basically by hydrolyzing water into oxygen and hydrogen and such. So, what I keep on going back to and trying to tell people is that efficiencies are never 100%, so you always have to concern yourself with what is the appropriate efficiency. Now, sometimes experimentally, under perfect situations, you can get a much better efficiency than you can for massive amounts of manufacture. So you have to kind of function in the real world. You have to figure out on how efficient these energy conversions are in the massive amounts that will be required to maintain a large number of transportation vehicles.
Toyota has also a truck, and it's a beautiful picture of the truck. A heavy truck, the trailer that is operating on hydrogen. One thing, and second thing is, I do thank you very much for correcting me with the price, but I have legitimate information. The only thing is that the person is kind of special. So the guy who got from Toyota the car for $15,000 was the Minister of Water Resources in Ukraine. Maybe there was some kind of special deal with them, or maybe in Europe they have a different pricing. I don't know. And to exchange.
WHVGT.
Yes, Charlie.
Wesley, it's very possible that they were trying to promote Ukraine to provide large numbers of these vehicles and give it at a very low price to someone who would have that influence. I mean, it's perfectly legitimate. I understand it. That's the net.
Yes, I mean, we need to take into consideration one thing. In Russia, people make approximately $100 pension per month, and $200 to $300 per month. It's a quite good money. In Ukraine, it's a little bit more, but still, people don't have much money, but the manufacturer wants to have a sale. So maybe for this part of the world, there is some special pricing. But anyhow, thank you very much for that information.
Sure, and thanks for mentioning this vehicle.
Yeah, check also the truck, the Toyota heavy truck. It's a white car, big, huge one. I believe Dr. Roy has a link to it, to 18-wheeler operating on hydrogen. Interesting is when we put hydrogen in the liquid form. I wasn't quite prepared to this. Usually I try to be prepared to the subject that I'm discussing, but I wasn't kind of. It was just minutes before the technique that I decided to discuss. And to exchange.
Yes, somebody like to reach and see.
Yes, Charlie.
It makes me curious that what Toyota, I mean, huge corporation, what they see in developing and starting to promote this, it would be interesting to contact them as the public and to find out what kind of efficiencies are involved and all the questions that were posed here as far as hydrogen production and distribution. Because a big company, I don't see a big company doing something like this just for the hell of it. You know, something's going on with them. Back to Ned.
Okay, I think we kind of chewed this up. Unfortunately, I take a look at Echolink, and Frank is there, saying he has a couple of questions when I'm able to leave a blank for him. Frank, is it have anything to do with this subject? Because we're kind of rushed for time for the SpaceNet report, but I'll leave the push to talk alone for a while, and you can tell me if this is a different topic or just something about something we've talked about.
Different topics, so we can say this for next week. I do have a topic for Paul Lowe also, so we can go on to him. Go ahead, WB2BX.
Okay, very good, Frank. Well, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and thanks especially to Wesley with the interesting question that provoked a lot of response and conversation and the exchange of bits and pieces of knowledge. I learned things. I hope other people out there learn things, and I want to thank everyone for that experience. But now it is time for Paul WS2N to give us the SpaceNet report. So take it away, Paul.
Yes, WS2N. Very good topic tonight. And, it was funny. You had no questions in the beginning before that topic really took off. Anyway, we do the SpaceNet report here every week. And, we review everything that's going on during the week with all the space companies and countries that are active around the world. As far as launches and landings, there's always quite a few of them going on. During the year now, I mean, you used to get up to like 90 or so launches. Now we're going way over 100 globally. So a lot to cover from week to week. One launch that's coming up is a Halloween launch. That's going to be four astronauts. Half of them are going to be hams. Roger Chary, Tom Washburn is a pilot. Kayla Barron, she's a mission specialist from NASA and then the European Space Agency, astronaut. Also Mathis Moya. And they'll be going up on a SpaceX Dragon crew vehicle on a Falcon 9 rocket to the International Space Station for about 6 months. And then right soon after that, you're going to have four that are already on board leave in another SpaceX Dragon crew vehicle detached from the Harmony node, you know, module, one of the big modules on the space station, and then come back and they bring them back in the Atlantic Ocean. They'll be picked up by SpaceX. So as far as launches and landings, that's the main one. There's a lot of unmanned vehicles that are going to be going up as well. But for now, I just wanted to cover this one topic that I put on Roy's website. He put on four pictures for me, and it's the microphones that are on board the Mars Perseverance rover that's riding around on Mars since February 18th of this year. Okay, now this 2,000 pound plus, I think it's 2,000, almost 2,300 pounds or so vehicle. Well, on Earth it weighs one third of that on Mars, but it's been riding around doing good science. And one of the things that they have on this one that they haven't had on any of the other vehicles, the other rovers, are microphones. They have two microphones. And one is located on the mass cam. That's the part that sticks straight up about 7 feet above the surface of the ground. That has a motor on it, has a stereo vision. Also has a laser that shoots out of it. They can shoot hit a laser, hit a laser target on a rock maybe 20, 30 feet away. They zap it. And by doing that, they could also record the with a spectrometer of what that rock is made of. But right below that that lens that you see on the rover, if you look at it, it's located around 7 o'clock. Seven o'clock position, coming out of that big, that one big lens that, that shoots the laser, is one of the microphones, and then there's another microphone mounted on the chassis, the body of the rover, and it would be actually on what you would call the passenger side or the left hand side. They have another microphone located there as well, and they've recorded many, many hours of sounds on Mars right now. They record the wheels, the sound the wheels make as it's going over the rocks. They record the motors, the sound of the motors as they're turning. The wheels, you know, four wheels turn. Each one has a motor. They record the motors of the arm, the 7-foot robotic arm that, that reaches over, does all the science with drill bits, and they can record the sounds of the drilling. They've even recorded the sounds of the helicopter, you know, the Ingenuity helicopter that Perseverance brought up with it. They've made many flights. I think they're up to flight 14. Originally, they were going to do no more than 5 flights, but it's become such a great instrument for helping out Perseverance that they just keep using it. Anyway, these microphones do all this kind of work, and the engineers like to hear the sounds as well. Just like, if you're working on a car and you listen to different noises here and there, it's the same type of thing. They can hear the noises. They'll notice the changes. Although they have telemetry coming back on all the motors, they can tell how many amps and how many volts everything's running. They can, you know, tell how many rotations the motor has made. All that information comes back. But they do like the idea of being able to hear it. And over time, over the months and eventually years, if they start to notice a change in the way things sound, that might give them a hint. You know, let's back off on using, you know, this motor more or that motor, but, you know, less. Let's favor this wheel instead of that wheel, that type of thing. Anyway, you could look at the microphones. They're electric microphones. Your standard. They're actually off the shelf type of microphones. They're made by Knowles, a company called Knowles, KNOWLES. Anyway, they make these microphones, electric microphones, and they're small. They're attached to the rover, and you can see what it looks like by looking at his website. And I thought it was pretty interesting, especially the one that's mounted on the chassis. You can see all these other connections that are made for everything else. You know, cables going out to heaters, cables going out to motors, and all kinds of things. And right near the very top of that whole assembly is the microphone. Anyway, as a ham, I thought that would be a good topic. Any questions, comments? And then, if not, we're going to go up to Frank. I know Frank has a question. Anybody have any questions on this topic? Okay, very good. And, by the way, if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, put that into the URL, and his website will come up. Let me stand by for WB2BXO.
I'll try that again. WB2BXO. Am I, can you repeat it?
Yes, you are, Frank. Sounds very good, too.
All right, it should, since I'm not actually on the radio, but, anyway, yeah, I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the hypersonic missile tests. Apparently, it's just become public that China fired presumably a hypersonic vehicle around the world. It's not clear to me whether it was a spacecraft or a cruise missile, and I'm not sure anybody, at least in the public domain, actually knows that answer. And the U.S. apparently responded with a test of its own last week. I was wondering if you had followed that at all. Go ahead.
Telling the story, but I'm probably getting as much information as you. First of all, I can't believe that our systems that are in place don't know what China's up to. You know, we've got all kinds of satellites in orbit, everything from very low Earth orbiting satellites, LEOs, or the satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit, monitoring, in particular, our adversaries. So for them not to know, where that came from, like you said, I haven't heard, did it come from a submarine? Did it come from an orbiting satellite? I don't know, but I have a feeling our government knows, but, we'll know, in time. The one test that we ran, we tried to send one in flight from Alaska, from the Kodiak launch facility. They don't know how they changed the name to Pacific. I think the Pacific Kodiak Launch Complex. Anyway, they sent it off from Alaska, and from what I understand, the booster failed, and therefore their hypersonic vehicle located on top of that never got a chance to be tested. So I guess they'll soon be able to put another test together. In fact, I think I read that another booster is on the way. I haven't read what kind of a booster they use. My guess is it's usually a solid booster rocket, because they're very, very reliable, but I haven't heard that yet. So I don't know why that failed. And a couple of suborbital tests to test other parts of the system out of Wallops Island, Virginia, within the last couple of weeks as well. So, I mean, that's a common place for suborbital tests. I haven't heard any results of, what came back from that. So we'll have to wait and see. I know Russia said that they tested one, like you said. Remember about a year or two ago, there was some kind of a blast in northern Russia, right near the Arctic Ocean. And they kind of covered that up. I think that might have been a test that they were planning that might have backfired on them. We never got the results on that. Let me drop it. And, of course, North Korea is involved with some kind of another test that they're saying that they launched from a sub, but I don't think that was a hypersonic vehicle. So we'll see what happens. So we've been doing these things for years. We had something, I think it was called the Wave Glider, and then that was about, 4 or 5 years ago. And that was launched from a Pegasus rocket on a, they have a Lockheed L-1011 that Grumman flies, and they dropped the Pegasus rocket, and that would be the booster, and then this waveguide thing is supposed to take off and go hypersonic. Ran a couple of those tests, like I said, about 4 or 5 years ago, and I think one failed, another one got going, but didn't get up to speed that they wanted to do. I think they wanted to do Mark 5. It's ongoing with us. We're probably not far behind. As far as we don't have one of these things developed as we speak, that might be top secret. I wouldn't be surprised if they have something already. Back to you, Frank. WB2BXLWS2S.
Yeah, Paul, very interesting. Yeah, the story on the Russian test failure is very peculiar. If I remember correctly, and please correct me if information or just plain wrong, was that there were reports of high levels of radiation and that some area was evacuated. Anyway, it was very peculiar. So speculation was that this was some kind of nuclear powered vehicle, though I guess it's also possible that somebody accidentally detonated a nuke. Nobody said that, so it's a guess on my part, though I think the speculation was, at least publicly, was that it was a nuclear-powered vehicle of some sort that failed them in that Russian test. Does that sound familiar? Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah, that rings a bell, but I remember seeing that. A couple of those stories, but I never got any kind of confirmation. I never read one way or the other. But I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to do something with a nuke. They've launched Fission. In fact, we did it once too. A Fission spacecraft. You know, you launch a rocket, and the spacecraft itself is working on Fission. They did a few of them. And then one eventually crashed in Canada, and that caused a lot of problems. Cosmos, I forget the number, but it was a fission vehicle. Yeah, they might have been trying to launch some kind of nuclear vehicle actually from the ground, which theoretically is possible. But I don't know. Wesley, over to you.
Yeah, it was... quite loud story. The European observatories, they have a censoring devices, and Russia is in the agreement to have a radiation control over their territory. They switch off the monitoring stations and reported the malfunction, like the job. In 1950s, United States of America and Russia were competing in building a nuclear-powered rocket. And in 2017, President Putin made a speech to the nation, but instead of making speech of the nation, he made a speech saying how Russia is strong and they have that weapon that can cruise forever, and they can also build a submarine which would be the nuclear bomb that could cruise forever, and they can attack the United States. They even made some kind of very much primitive animation that was showing a part of Florida, and that airborne rocket with the nuclear engine that is spreading a nuclear warhead over there, that territory. Let me go. So the problem with the nuclear engine from 50s was that President Putin in 2017 was trying to reincarnate, if I say it properly, the technology. But the technology leaves the trace of the radioactive dust. So anywhere it moves, it goes with the trail. And the trail is spotted because it drifts. And it appears that it was unsuccessful launch of such a rocket, and they stopped that because of the consequences from the international community. And to exchange.
Very good, Wesley. Yeah. Anything that guy says That's why I have 2 ears, Wesley. It goes in one ear right out the other. I don't pay attention to Putin at all. He says a lot of stuff. I'm sure he's worked on a lot of things, but, you know, they're still way far behind. It is good that we're involved with them with the space station now. You know, I mean, that helps smooth things out, that's for sure. You know, they're interested in our technology. We're interested in theirs. We've actually gotten a lot of help from their science, you know, their engineers, and the other way around. So, you know, ever since the 1974, Apollo Soyuz docking. I think that was a very, very smart thing to do. And it's led to us visiting the Mir space station when it's in orbit. And what we have today with the International Space Station, over 20 countries involved, including Russia, Japan, Canada. Good move. But as far as all these weapons and things that I guess he could say a lot of things. I wouldn't bet against our technology, what we have, and the half the things that we probably don't know that we have. Anyway, let me just continue on. Just wanted a couple of other topics. There's a laser communication satellite that's going to go up, LCRD. They call it the Laser Communication Relay Demonstration. And let's see if Russia has this one. This one's going to transmit infrared laser and receive from a geosynchronous satellite. There's an Atlas 551 going up. That's an Atlas V rocket with five solid boosters attached to it. So it's our largest rocket. And for now, anyway, that NASA has, and that will be sending a regular satellite into geosynchronous orbit, a regular big, 8,000-pound satellite. But attached to it, they're going to have this experimental laser deal, this laser communications relay demonstration set up, and they're going to be transmitting and receiving instead of RF using laser beams. And testing out transmitting video and all kinds of data. And they want to see how that goes, because eventually that could lead to we're orbiting the moon in the Gateway space station, or maybe even from the from a base on the moon, we could be transmitting back and forth using laser, including the going to Mars. You'd be able to actually transmit video from Mars to Earth. Of course, it wouldn't be real time. You know, you might be 10, 20 minutes away as far as the signal getting from one point to the other, but when it showed up, you'd have a video. Right now, that would be impossible. If you had a station on Mars, and you were transmitting an RF, you wouldn't get the... you wouldn't get that. Maybe in the X-band, you can get a little bit, but you could perfect this system. I mean, that's going to be great. They've done something similar to this in the past. We sent a satellite to in lunar orbit, and then separated from the main satellite, and it was flying on its own, and it transmitted video from the moon to Earth, which worked out. But it wasn't a two-way deal. Right now, they're going to actually try transmitting from Earth to the satellite back down to Earth, or maybe to the space station and back, you know, that type of thing. Deal. Instead of using a TDRS satellite, which we use today, we have 11 TDRS satellites. TDRS is a tracking data relay satellite that we have in orbit, geosynchronous orbits around the Earth. We use it for everything from Hubble to the space station. And space station, that's the way it works. They're transmitting, their antenna is looking up to the tracking data relay satellite and then coming back down, usually White Sands, New Mexico, and then going from there to wherever it has to go to. Also back up in that fashion as well. And that's why you have these couple of minute dropouts once in a while. You get over like the Indian Ocean. They'll drop out for a minute or two and then come back. Back in the 60s, they used to drop out like forever, you know. You watch the watch these things go around and around, and you know, they'd be out of touch with ground communications for, you know, 10, 15 minutes at a time. They didn't have the TETRA satellites in those days. So they have visions of someday maybe not replacing but supplementing laser communication in geosynchronous orbit to eventually, replace or supplement the TETRA system that we have. Much smaller equipment, runs on very little power. You don't need as big solar cells. Weight is everything when it comes to launching things into space. If you drive the course down, that's the way to go. Any questions or comments? WS2M.
I have a question. I'm not familiar with the laser leak, but it looks like it must be pointed at the particular station from the distance between the Mars and that satellite is giving a certain width of the laser beam that is shoot from the Mars station, but then what is the position of the satellite? If it's geostationary, then it will be accessible only in a very short period of time. I'm kind of confused with that texture.
With the Mars concept? Well, yeah, because that's nowhere near being developed. This one is geosynchronous, so looks like they're going to be using White Sands, New Mexico as one location, which is what they pretty much use a lot for the TETRA system now. And the one drawing that I saw, they also showed it going to the International Space Station, so that'll be flying around. So that will, because they only have one of these satellites at this time, you'll only have a short window for, you know, when the space station is on the proper side of the Earth. But White Sands, they could do that, you know, 24/7. Mars one, that's going to be different. You know, they'll probably be transmitting, I guess, up to a orbiting satellite in Mars orbit, and that thing will probably transmit back to another satellite. Earth orbit, the power levels, everything will have to be increased, and that's a long way off. But definitely the moon. They've actually done the moon. But that's pretty much all I know about it. Back to you, Wesley.
I don't see the problem with shooting at the satellite. The width of the laser beam will be extremely white for that distance. I don't see the problem with the power. The photon put in motion, stay in motion, and there is no obstacles. The problem that I see is that if we implement a satellite around the Mars, then the satellite will have its own orbit. And I don't know if it's going to be geostationary, Mars stationary, so to say, comparing to the movement of the satellite around the Earth. So if you wouldn't mind to say a few words more and to actually...
You could probably have an orbit that was favoring the Earth most of the time, you know, spacing. You know, where it could be facing the Earth. And yeah, I should have sent that over to Roy's website. it had, they showed it, like the difference of RF, how wide the beam was compared to this laser beam hitting the Earth. Yeah, I mean, they talk about it's 100-to-1 ratio for data, and that's now. You know, they'll develop that even more as time goes on. But that tells me, you know, the beam, the comparison between the beam it was like a pinpoint going to one location on Earth compared to a wide beam of RF. But we'll look at it this. Like I said, this thing's going up very shortly in November, and I'm sure I'll read more about it. I'll bring it back to the net. Wesley, back to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your explanation.
I'll be happy when getting a system like that from, let's say, the Gateway space station that will be going around the moon, or of course from a lunar base. I could just picture a video going back and forth, you know, in two directions. You know, those people are going to want to see what's going on Earth, and that's why I like this particular satellite. It's one step better than what they sent to the moon, but it's all in the works. I know inside of a couple of years they're gonna have a prominent location. You know, maybe for one of these, more than one, maybe a half a dozen of these satellites going around in geosynchronous orbit, doing the same work that the tracking data relay satellites are doing now. I wanted to talk about the Lucy mission. That I probably talked about more times than I can imagine on this net, because it did launch last week on the way to Jupiter, following orbit.
That time complete.
Goal is to get to, not into Jupiter orbit, but going to go into the orbit that Jupiter tracks. It'll be in front of it, looking for these Trojan asteroids that have collected there since the beginning of the solar system. And eventually it will move on to the ones that are following behind it in the L4 and the L5 position. Well, they launched it last week. It has a half a dozen different instruments on board, including a camera. I think it was a couple of hundred. I think this was I think it's probably around $700 million project to get this thing to finally launch. Got two big solar panels that fan open 25 feet in diameter.
One more coming.
1 second, Wesley. But these two things open up 25 feet in diameter. In Earth orbit, around 15,000 watts you can get. They say more, but 15,000, where once it gets near near Jupiter, it will only be getting around 500 watts. I remember talking about this on the net last week and a week before. Those solar panels, one opened up perfectly, the other one didn't latch, and they're still looking at the telemetry to see what went wrong. But they are both operating, so they might just leave it alone. You know, it might do its mid-course correction, these burns, when the thrusters go off. They're testing it now to see if that would affect anything with those, essentially a loose solar panel. But it didn't latch. But they said that they're getting like over 90% of the power from it anyway, so if they don't fix it, at least it'll continue to work, and it's not going to stop the mission. It's a 12-year mission. Okay, back over to you, Wes.
Oh, it was about the laser, but I don't want to disturb you finish, and then I make a comment.
That's pretty much it, unless somebody has a question about Lucy, but I know I've covered that extensively on the net. I don't want that selling, but I just want to bring that up because it was launched last week, and they do have this one problem that they're working on. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, but just to get an idea about the communication using laser between Mars and the Earth, not difficult task. The technology is known from 1988, when the media was blown out by a new form of applying laser beam. Although the laser wasn't much popular at the time. Bouncing an invisible laser beam off the window and attempting to catch the reflection is a little like playing 3D billiards blindfolded. The fun increases exponentially with the distance from the target, as if it doesn't make reception difficult enough. The greater the angle of incidence, the greater the distortion of the received sound. But the amateurs and their hosts are able to build a laser that is able to sense the vibration of the window at a far distance and listening to the conversation inside the room. So that's how easy it is, and to share.
Okay, at least it's doable. You know, that's good. And from 1988, did that come from the Star Wars program that Reagan wanted to do? Is that where that is that when they started?
Okay, I'm going to read it. Back in 1988, newspaper reports about laser beam eavesdropping swept the country. Our clients were scared. To learn exactly how scared they should be, were to build a laser beam eavesdropping system and conducted a series of experiments. The following report to the clients is that the result of those experiments plus our updated research was very much promising. So that was that is the part of the article from 1988. And to XGM.
Very good. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see. Let's see how the LCRD, the laser communications relays demonstration works out. And my guess is it's going to work out fine. You need that. There's a tremendous amount of data that is being sent back and forth now to the International Space Station. And there's stuff that they have on board that they want to transmit down. It's just, you know, it's too many megabytes. So if they could even have this now for the space station, the scientists would love it. They would just love it. May I be happy with CW, but the more data that they can squeeze into 1 second, the better that those scientists will be. I just want to mention the Progress, Russian Progress spacecraft, that's one of the ones that's attached to the International Space Station right now, pulling back, separated, but then eventually it's going to redock with the Nyoka module, and the idea is to they're actually setting up the Nyoka module to accept another module that Russia's going to be sending up very shortly to it, which is a big docking module. It's like 16 feet long, you know, like 8 or 10 feet in diameter. It's got 6 ports on it, and you'll be able to do multiple things with this one setup once they attach it to the space station. But to do that, Nyoka, which was just sent up like a month and a half ago, and which successfully docked to the space station, to the Zvezda Russian module, but unfortunately soon afterwards the thrusters started misfiring unnecessarily, and it was actually trying to pull away from the space station, but because it was attached, it actually spun the whole space station. It's like spinning a 30-story building around, and it flipped over 1.5 turns. By the time they were able to use other thrusters from a Progress spacecraft, and eventually slowed it down and stopped it and they use the control moment gyros to form massive ones in the center of the space station, which also help help correct our problem. Anyway, they straighten out Nioka, and they realize that now the thrusters are not going to fire anymore, and they're starting to outfit it properly the way they planned. It's going to take quite a few EVAs or spacewalks to do that by the Russians. Anyway, they're going to take this Progress vehicle and dock it with Nioka. Right now there's a Russian docking ring that they actually want to get rid of, a docking adapter. So they're going to attach the vehicle to it, and then they're going to separate from Nioka, except pulling the that ring away, and then eventually burning up over the South Pacific Ocean. Now that leaves a larger connection that the Russians would normally use for attaching another module. Well, here comes another module within a month called the Prinkle. We're going to send this thing up with six sides, so one side will attach to the Nioka module, and then they'll have the other sides to either add more modules or at least to be able to dock with future spacecraft that will be coming up. So I don't know. The Russians have finally increased their size recently by doing what they're doing. It took them over 11 years to get this one particular module up. Its chip gone up 11 years ago, but now it's finally attached to the space station. They now have a lot more room. They were dropping down to, they wanted to drop down to just two crewmen, two Russians, because they didn't have enough space, or, they couldn't have, they didn't have enough of everything. You know, this new one has a new bathroom, and, they finally caught up to where they wanted to be. So now they were able to bring up, recently they just had a mission where an actress went up and a director filmed a movie up there on the space station, for 12 days. It became a 12-day movie theater, a movie studio. Anyway, they're able to do that now. Now they're going to bring up another billionaire. This guy is... made his money with clothes in Japan, going up very shortly too. And now they take money from these billionaires. When I say they, the Russians, and they now have the room to store these people. And they're also going up for about 2 weeks. And it's the same billionaire that he also signed up with SpaceX. So, he still is flying up SpaceX. He has plans on eventually getting on a Starship and flying, doing orbits around the moon and taking a half a dozen people with him. But he's a little anxious to get to space, so he made a deal with a place called Space Adventures. Space Adventures actually is located in the United States, in Virginia. And they'll, for a small sum of around $50 million or so, probably more now, probably up. I wouldn't be surprised if it's up to $70 million. But they'll find you up to a 12-day stint on the International Space Station with Russia. Any comments or questions? If not, I'm going to start closing down here because looking at the time, it's 12 minutes after the hour. WS2N. Okay, very good. Thank you for staying by, anybody listening to us, and everybody that participated, especially in this part of the net. Back next week with more of our updates from the space community. And there's plenty of things to talk about. Looks like plenty of money is being poured into space industry commercially around the globe, different countries. See how long it lasts. We'll turn back to you, Roy, AC2GS. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
2GS. Thank you, Paul, for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for your participation in this net in general, and the club especially. Everyone appreciates it. Just want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I had an enjoyable conversation. I hope the other people did as well.